Let's see what happens. Okay, so the first question, do you ask how to overcome negative thoughts while meditating? Thank you. Okay, so this is, I think, very important part of the Buddhist practice, of meditation practice, not only of meditation, but also of our daily life, how to overcome these things. And this is part of this whole process of purification I was talking about earlier on today, the idea that we overcome all the negative defilements, all the problems of the mind, all the problems in life, basically. Yeah. And of course, it's very useful if you overcome these things in the mind. It's very useful because it affects our conduct as well, our speech, our habits, everything gets kind of sorted out if we can overcome the negative states of mind. So basically what it is all about, and very often these negative mind states, they often concern other people, right? One of the perhaps biggest problems that we often have is with other people in our lives. So often what we have, one of the kind of basic things that we have to learn to do is to understand that people are often very complex. People have many sides to them. And often it is a matter of which aspect of that person we focus on. If you focus on the wrong aspect, negative thoughts arise. If you focus on a different aspect, which you might call the right one, from a Buddhist point of view, then you feel differently about that person. You feel neutral, or maybe you even feel positive, right? So it's all about how we use our mind, how we focus on things that actually makes us either overcome or indulge in those negative states. So try looking at that person differently here. Ask yourself, if it is a person that we're talking about here, ask yourself what are the good signs of that person. And then build up that perception, build up that idea of all those good qualities. One of the things about being part of a Buddhist community is that, you know, there are so many good qualities, so much positive things to focus on, right? People who go on retreats, people who keep precepts, people who do kind things in the world, people who are generous. There's so much goodness to focus on in a Buddhist community. So, especially when you come here on retreat, remember that. Remember all the goodness, right? And all the trivial little things that may cause negative states of mind. They're so insignificant in comparison to all the positive things. So you remember the goodness, and then as soon as the negative mind arises, you shift your focus. Remember all the good points. And then the negative thing just dies down and disappears so quickly. So this is one way. One of the suttas I want to look at later on is about this thing in particular. And then, of course, sometimes there are people who are you find very difficult. You know, people who you may be at work or wherever, maybe friends or family members or whatnot. And if somebody is very difficult and you find it very hard to see the positive qualities, then you look to compassion instead. Because somebody who has a lot of negative qualities, they also have a very bad life, right? They have a very miserable existence if they have so many bad qualities. Not only is it bad now, but it's producing more badness for themselves in the future. Lots of suffering are being created because of that. And this is another one of the suttas I will talk about later on. So then when you understand that somebody is creating suffering for themselves, nobody wants to create suffering for themselves, right? It's madness. You understand that they are deluded, because that's the only reason why people create suffering for themselves. They are deluded. They don't understand what they're doing here. They're crazy, basically. And then, of course, once you see it that way, you can have a sense of compassion rather than get upset, rather than get angry, etc. So again, you use that perception, and these are perceptions you have to build up, you have to kind of spend some time to give them a sense of substance, a sense of weight, and then in your meditation practice you can shift very quickly from one to the other one. It's very powerful in meditation practice especially. So be on the watch out, okay, you see that negative state about to arise. You allow it to arise, or it arises by itself. Quickly, you shift your attention before it gains a foothold. As soon as it gets a strong foothold, it's very often very difficult to change the perception. So you've got to be fairly quick about these things. So this is the way usually to deal with negative mind states, and especially regarding people. That's usually the biggest problem, I think. Yeah. Okay, so if that did not really answer your full question, then please get back to me later on. I will try next time instead, see what happens. Okay. Dear Ajahn, this morning you talked about the sequence from virtue, joy, rapture, tranquility, and pleasure. Is it important for me to be able to differentiate joy, happiness, rapture, pleasure, because they seem to be descriptions of the same thing? Thank you. The idea is not so much that you have to differentiate these things. The idea is more that you understand that there is a path there of different intensities of these things, right? There's a different degrees of tranquility. There's different degrees of happiness. There's different profundity to these things. And very often you will know the initial happiness that comes in meditation, the very beginning, is likely to be the very first stage that I was talking about the other day. And then that stage becomes more and more profound. If you're more and more peaceful, the happiness is more and more subtle, right? More and more beautiful. So it's this amazing thing. You sit down and you meditate and you start to feel a bit of joy. And that already is wonderful, right? Wow, delightful. And that's only the beginning, right? That's only the very starting point. And then it becomes more and more profound. And this is kind of the part of this is also the encouragement. It's this remarkable, amazing path which has such incredible depth, where there's so much happiness, so much release from problems and suffering here. And it is very inspiring just to read about these things. At least it is for me, and I'm sure for many of you as well. You feel very inspired. You feel, wow, this is so fabulous. So don't worry too much about exactly where you're at. That doesn't matter so much. What matters is that you have an idea of where this is going here. So you're starting off, and then just see whether it is becoming more peaceful, moving towards tranquility, whether the happiness is becoming more refined. And if that is what is happening, you know you're heading in the right direction. And then when you start to move towards samadhi, you will know that things are really starting to happen. The mind is becoming very still, very unified. You get all these kind of things happening, like lights in the mind, all these kind of things. I think that is the most important thing. Then you have a rough idea of what's happening. And over time, you will gain familiarity with these things more. Okay, Ajahn, what kind of samadhi is wrong samadhi? And I think the answer to that is that wrong samadhi is the samadhi which is based on wrong view, right? The whole Noble Eightfold Path, it starts off with the right view, and then you go stage by stage, each one leading all the way up to samadhi, right samadhi. But if you start off with the wrong view, then you may do certain things right, and maybe you even get into a state of samadhi. But because the view is wrong, that samadhi would be called wrong samadhi on the Buddhist path. Because it is wrong samadhi, because it starts off with the wrong view, you will misunderstand what is going on. You will take it as something which it actually is not. And that is why it is called wrong samadhi. It won't take you any further. The whole idea with samadhi is then to give rise to insight, to understand things according to reality, right? This is the whole purpose of that. But if you start off with the wrong view, it will not lead to that insight, that understanding. That is really the idea, I think, behind that. It is never really explained very clearly in the suttas, but sometimes right samadhi is explained as that one-pointedness or that stillness of mind which is supported by the other seven factors of the path. It sort of implies that if it's not supported by those, it might be wrong samadhi. Okay, Divanab Ajahn Brahmali, you mentioned the Arya path in part of your Dhamma talk. Can only monks or nuns become Aryas, or can householders too? To what level is it possible for a layman or laywoman to attain? Thank you for this very special retreat to benefit all of us. Okay, with metta. There is no kind of exclusivity to these things. Anyone can really attain any state on the path. So you can become a stream enterer, which is Arya means a noble person, right? A noble person is someone who has seen the full teaching of the Buddha through insight. Anyone can really attain that. It doesn't matter whether you are monastic or not. But of course, there is a reason why the Buddha laid down the monastic life. And the reason for that is because it is the best vehicle for attaining these things. Especially if monastic life is well lived. Of course, it's possible to live monastic life badly, in which case not very useful. But if it is well lived, you have the right kind of teachings and things are well, then it is supposed to be the best vehicle for these things. And I'll probably talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. And the reason for that is that there are many reasons for that. But one reason is that this whole middle path of Buddhism is a path away from craving for sensual pleasures, right? And as a monastic, you're more removed from that. The very fact that you are celibate means that you have to turn your mind in a different direction, right? So you're moving away from those things more powerfully than you are usually in anywhere, maybe not always, but usually in lay life. Then there is the other things about monastic life, the more powerful kalyanamittas, right? The noble friendship that you have in monastic life. You have many people who are thinking in the same way, heading in the same direction. That perhaps there is more talk about monastic things. There's that support. There is what Ajahn Brahm calls the osmosis factor, right? If you have a good senior monk, there's kind of an osmosis that takes place. You kind of absorb it. You absorb the Dhamma. Whether you want to or not, it kind of penetrates after a while. That's the osmosis effect. You have more of that osmosis in monastic life than you have in lay life. Is one of the benefits. You have people around you who, you know, discuss the suttas, discuss the teachings of the Buddha. Sometimes people who are very, very good at those things, very sharp, have a very profound understanding of these things. All of these things help you. And I think kalyanamitta especially is a very important factor. We will see that tomorrow again. It's one of those foundation factors without which there is really no progress at all on the Buddhist path. Then there is the solitude you have as a monk, right? I mean, I live in a small hut in the forest at Bodhinana Monastery, have this own hut for myself, and when I'm in my kuti, I can't hear or see anyone else. It's just, you feel really far away. It's this kind of ideal thing for cultivating the Buddhist path. This is quite good to come here to Jhana Grove. It's great. It's kind of a halfway house between lay life and monastic life, right? But it's even better. Maybe actually not always. That's actually maybe not quite correct. Depending how good your meditation is going. But if your meditation is going well, then it's even better to have complete solitude in your own duty. Sometimes it's nice to have the support of a group, but there comes a point when you actually want to have even more solitude. So all of these things are really conducive for are the good things that are conducive for the practice of the path, the things that make monastic life. Can make monastic life preferable. But in principle, the attainments are open to anyone, all the attainments, even arahantship. It's possible to become an arahant as a layperson, except that they say that once you become an arahant, that's it, you finish as a layperson and you become a monastic, at least in your heart, right? Because basically you have no more attachments, there's nothing more in the world that is of any interest to you whatsoever. So you are a monastic at heart from the moment you become an arahant. So it's one of the ways you know whether a lay person has become an arahant. It's pretty rare though. It doesn't happen all that often. But yes. So essentially it is open. So there's always no need to be discouraged if you are a lay person. Just keep on doing the right thing. Keep on practicing the right way. And eventually you will make that kind of progress. But what is the most difficult thing on the Buddhist path is to have that sense of perseverance, the sense of commitment that actually makes this possible. That is the most difficult thing, yeah? Because it takes a lot of commitment, a lot of perseverance. It's not difficult to do, but it takes that perseverance. Okay, if you're not happy with my questions or whatever, then please write down another question tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, walking meditation, how does it help? 2, can it lead to jhana? 3, where did the Buddha teach walking meditation? Thank you. Okay, walking meditation, how does it help? It helps in many different ways. People often ask, how do you do walking meditation? And the answer is there isn't any one way of doing it. You can do it in many different ways. I remember when we had this Burmese monk, Utejaneya, here. He just said, well, when you do walking meditation, just walk back and forth. Don't do anything at all. Just relax, right? Just enjoy the walking back and forth. Don't need to focus on anything. And he was into observing the mind, Chittanupassana. And he just talked about walking back and forth. And this is actually quite nice, you know. After having sat for a while, you feel maybe a bit stiff or you feel whatever. And you had enough perhaps of focusing on the breath or anything. And just go out and just enjoy yourself a little bit. Just walk back and forth. Feel the peace of jhana grow, right? Especially on an evening tonight, you sit in here and it feels so delightful. It feels so, just feels nice, right? So do that. Go out, enjoy the walking back and forth. Don't focus on anything in particular. And just kind of, get into the walking itself and just enjoy that. That is one way, and I think that is quite a useful way, because especially if you feel tired of sitting down, especially if you feel that you've had enough of this kind of focusing meditation, it's nice just to relax a little bit. If you want to focus on samadhi, you want to continue your focus on this particular object, while you're walking, you can just watch your feet. Watch your feet as you're walking. Keep your focus on your feet. Feel the feet as they touch the ground, as you move from one foot to another one. And feel just the whole process of walking. That can be your focus of meditation, if you want a focus of meditation as you do the walking. And that can give rise to very profound meditation. I especially, Ajahn Brahm always talks about his meditation during walking meditation. One of the biggest problems in the monastery that we always kind of not really argue about it, but this is Ajahn Brahm's love affair with concrete. He loves concrete, and the reason that he says he loves concrete was because in his young days at Wat Manachat in Thailand, they had a concrete floor, right, in the hall, and they did walking meditation on this concrete floor. And Ajahn Brahm's meditation, he always had very good meditation, not always perhaps, but for a long time. And when he was walking on this concrete floor, his mind would become so still. He would see all these things popping out of the concrete floor, these colors and shapes. It was so powerful and so beautiful. And ever since then, he has loved concrete. So he wants to have concrete here, there, and everywhere, right? This is Ajahn Brahm. So we're saying, oh, Ajahn, can we please have something else? Anyway, so that's the power of the meditation. That's the power that can happen while you are doing walking meditation. Your perceptions start to change, right? Because of the power of the bliss and all these things that are coming up as a consequence. Can you reach jhana? Usually, it's a bit dangerous to reach jhana while you're walking. Usually what happens, if you become that peaceful, you don't really want to walk anymore, so you sit down. That's usually when you go into a jhana state. I'm not sure if it is possible even to get into a jhana while actually walking it. I somehow doubt it. Where did the Buddha teach walking meditation? He doesn't actually say much about walking meditation in the suttas. It is mentioned in passing. It is says in a few places. It says the five benefits of walking meditation. It is sometimes said the monks are walking up and down and these kind of things. The Buddha doesn't give any particular instructions for that. The reason, I think, is because there isn't really any particular instructions. Anything can be done in walking meditation. So far, I mentioned just walking back and forth. I mentioned just watching your feet. But you can also do contemplation while you do walking meditation, right? A very important part of the Buddha's path is to contemplate things, to reflect on the teachings. You can think about the teachings given here and think about them. What do they mean to you? Are you able to allow them to sink in a bit more deeply here. You can think about these teachings. You can do death contemplation. I will talk more about death contemplation later on. It's a very powerful contemplation and incredibly useful. And the Buddha said everybody should do death contemplation. He specifically said everybody, whether you're monastic or layperson or whatever, everybody should do this. So that's very, very powerful. Death contemplation can be incredibly useful. It makes the present moment much more significant, right? It really drives you into the present moment when you do death contemplation, because the rest of the world becomes insignificant. If you're going to die, everything else is really insignificant. It's only the now that matters. So it can be very, very powerful. powerful that way. You can do metta while you're walking, right? If you have problem with a negative mind states and you have perhaps negative perceptions of people or whatever, you can build up those positive views, those positive perceptions during meditation practice. Now, what are the good points in this person? And you build that up and say, yeah, there's lots of beauty there, lots of nice things going on. And then you change your perception away from the negative thing you had. You build that up, and then when you sit down, you come back here, you have built up something that you can turn to if the negativity arises again. All of these things can be done, and much more. Any kind of meditation you like to do, any kind of perception that you like to develop, any contemplation on any kind of theme of Dhamma, all of these things can be done while you are walking. Sometimes walking actually is quite useful for contemplation because you are moving, so the mind is a bit more active, the mind is a bit more, becomes kind of conditioned by the body a little bit, movement is more easy, so it can be quite useful to contemplate. Remember the Buddha always talked about the teachings that we receive in the here in the canon. It is not enough just to hear them. You actually have to contemplate them. And as you contemplate them, that's when they start to penetrate. And eventually, they become very powerful teachings. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn, sometimes I feel the pleasure of meditation, but how can I trust the suttas hasn't changed over the past years, come by oral tradition? Yes, that is a good question. And the answer to that is that we can know with a fairly high degree of certainty that the suttas that we have now are very, not exactly word for word what the Buddha said, but very, very similar to the word of the Buddha. And the reason we can know that is manifold, but one of the reasons is what they call the comparative study of the suttas. The suttas have been transmitted in many different lines of transmission. Some of those lines have been translated into Chinese, to Tibetan, some exist in Sanskrit, some exist in Pali. And some of these lines of transmission have been separate for 2,200 years, right? Almost back to the time of the Buddha. Very long period of separation. And if you compare the different suttas, right, and you look at them, you can see that these different traditions, the same suttas still exist in these different traditions. And when you compare the content, you find the content is astonishingly similar in these different traditions. So similar, in fact, that there are passages that are verbatim exactly the same after 2,200 years. It's hard to believe that, but that actually is the case. Sometimes there has been small corruptions, of course, because of oral transmission and other transmissions, but very often it has been kept incredibly intact over that period of time. And the reason for that, I would guess, is simply that people took these suttas as being very sacred, very important. They placed an enormous amount of emphasis on remembering them correctly. And because of that emphasis, because of that, that confidence and faith in those teachings, they were actually able to keep them in this way. So I don't think there is much doubt that what we have now is essentially the word of the Buddha, especially those teachings that you find in many different places, right? That you find with small variations across the board. You find them in the Chinese, sometimes you find them in Sanskrit, you find them in the Pali, and they're all basically exactly the same. I don't think there can be any doubt that they still exist. In particular, that sutta I was reading out on yesterday morning, the one about starting with sila, then we have the joys of meditation, the samadhi, that one exists in many versions in the Chinese, verbatim, exactly the same. I've read it myself, so I know exactly what it's like. So, there you are. That's my take on that one. Okay. Dear Venerable Ajahn, this is the most marvelous beginning for any of the retreats that I have attended. Thank you very much. My question is, does the applying of lip balm okay, to prevent the cracking of lips violate the vilepana of the seventh precept, specifically if the balm is of a non-fragrant type? Thank you. No, that is perfectly okay. Please apply as much lip balm as you like. There some things are medicines and some things are cosmetics, right? So if you do things for medicinal reasons, it's perfectly okay. That's no problems at all. I'm sure there are monks who apply lip balm as well in the monastery. Is that right? I'm sure there are, because it is a medicine, right? It's something that you really need to do. But if you kind of look yourself in the mirror afterwards to check out what you look like, then maybe it's not such a good idea. This is the distinction between medicine and what you do to kind of to feel that you look right or whatever. Yeah. So please do so. Okay, Dear Ajahn, have you thought about writing a book, i.e., Buddha's teaching according to the suttas as explained by Ajahn Brahmali? Okay, that could be the title. You have a wonderful gift of explaining the Dhamma in an accessible way, and only 60 people at a time can attend your retreat. Or maybe putting together an audiobook of your edited talks would be the way to go. In any case, big thanks for sharing your wisdom. Okay, that's very kind of you to say that. It's strange, isn't it? We have like Ajahn Brahmali's, this is just another commentary on the suttas. And sometimes, you know, we reject the commentaries by others, and then we kind of speak our own commentary, right? This is often usually what happens. But anyway, yes, maybe one day. It's already happening to some extent, because some of the little booklets have come out of teachings I have given in Olamara on dependent origination and that sort of thing. So things are sort of happening to some extent anyway. So maybe one of these lifetimes I'll get around to this. I'm not sure about this lifetime, but we'll see what happens. So. Okay, last question for tonight. How do I combat my body falling asleep even when I am concentrating on what is being said? Uh-oh. Is it possible? So that's maybe I need to do something to kind of make my voice more exciting or something. Okay, so combat. Well, please don't combat too much. Combat usually is not a good thing to do in meditation practice. If you start combating, then it usually means that you're using far too much force. So please allow yourself to sleep. And if you fall asleep while I am talking or whatever, that's perfectly okay. We will forgive you if you start snoring. So no problem with that. It's important to be able to relax, right? This is just so important. And if we put too much pressure on ourselves to stay awake when it isn't natural and doesn't happen by itself, usually you just feel uncomfortable after a while. So if you feel very sleepy, just go back to your room, lie down, have another snooze, and see if things after a while start to clear up, if you become less tired. There's two kinds of tiredness in meditation. One kind of tiredness is a natural kind of tiredness that comes because you had a very busy life. So you come here and you feel tired for a few days, and after a few days you start to brighten up, your mind kind of comes back to action again. And that is a sort of tiredness that will disappear by just resting enough. And if you use combat techniques to overcome that tiredness, you will just get more tired and it won't actually go away. So just allow yourself that enough, sufficient rest, whatever it takes basically. If the tiredness persists over time, then the reason why it persists is because the mind isn't bright enough yet. The mind isn't bright enough comes from exactly what we were talking about yesterday, that you haven't actually cultivated your mind in ordinary life enough. Not enough sila, not enough of avoiding the bad things and doing the good stuff. Maybe your mind is too negative, too many negative thoughts, right? Negative thoughts sap the energy of the mind and you tend to feel tired as a consequence. But what you have to do then is learn to turn the mind around, to look at things differently, cultivate the positive things instead. This is really, we're talking about sila, this changing the mind, changing the mental attitude is a very, very important part of the sila, of that aspect of one's personality, who one is basically as a person. And then gradually, you will be able to overcome these things. Don't feel frustrated if you feel tired a lot. A lot of people feel tired in meditation. It is very, very common. just accept it for what it is, right? You are who you are. You're okay. It doesn't matter if you feel tired. This is where you're at. It's important to be honest with yourself so you can actually move forward in a good way. If you're not honest with yourself, you don't accept yourself for who you are, you're not going to be able to move forward in a good way. So it's okay. First of all, no judgment, right? And then when you have no judgment, then you can start to do the right thing and actually change what is going on. And gradually, you will build up that energy in the mind, build up that feeling inside of energy, of brightness, of light. And then meditation will start to take off and everything will turn around. But remember, it is a commitment, not just for here on the retreat. It is a commitment that takes a lot of work also in daily life. And the more you're able to integrate the Buddhist path into everything you do, your whole life, the more and the greater will be the effects when you eventually come to Jhana Grove or anywhere else for that matter and do some more serious meditation practice. Okay, so those are the questions for this evening. Please continue enjoying yourself and we'll see you again tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. Thank you.